happy to announce that the Fretboard Journal now has three presenting sponsors. These are three brands that are behind us with everything that we do, including the podcasts and the videos, and they include Carter Vintage. Carter Vintage Guitars, where guitar lovers go for a good time. Gibson Guitars, only a Gibson is good enough. And last but not least, Martin Guitars. Martin Guitars and Strings remain the choice for musicians around the world for their unrivaled quality, craftsmanship, and tone. Can't thank these three brands enough for being presenting sponsors. Thank you, guys. Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I am Jason Verlinde from the Fretboard Journal magazine. Thank you all for tuning in. Please keep the podcast feedback coming over at podcast@fretboardjournal.com. And if you truly love the show, please leave us a review over on Apple Podcasts, as it helps other people from around the world find our little podcast. So since this pandemic hit, we've been recording a lot of podcast interviews. A lot of people are at home. They have time to talk, sometimes for the first time. We've had a handful of interviews that have just been truly profound, I think. You are about to hear one of them. Michael Millard is celebrating his 50th anniversary of building guitars. Michael, of course, is the guy behind Froggy Bottom Guitars. You've seen them on the back page of the Fretboard Journal since our inception. Thank you, Michael, for supporting us. Michael is at a point in his career where he can think about things perhaps a little deeper than some of us do. And I truly enjoyed this conversation. For the entire run of Froggy Bottom's history, they've kind of marched to the beat of their own drummer. They have their own business plan, which you'll hear about. And they make exceptional, beautiful acoustic guitars. So I think you will love this interview. If you did love it after hearing it and want to go a little deeper, by all means, go back in time 5 years to the podcast I did with Michael Gurian. That was Fretboard Journal podcast 91, a long time ago, because that'll help fill in some of the gaps on this history. And you might also like the podcast I just did with Richard Hoover, Fretboard Journal podcast 281. Richard, of course, of Santa Cruz Guitars, another profound and thoughtful and amazing luthier legend, I guess we can say. As always, this podcast is brought to you by our friends over at Mono Cases. You can go to monocreators.com to see their entire lineup of gig bags and studio monitor stands and backpacks. Everything they do, whether it's for an acoustic guitar or an electric guitar or a pedal board, is so well thought out and so well built. And we are also brought to you by our friends over at Retrofret Vintage Guitars in New York, who happen to have one of the coolest sort of player's grade beater vintage acoustics I've seen in a while, a 1942 Marden 015 that had some work done. But if you're anything like me, you're kind of looking around your house wondering, I'm going a little stir crazy. I want to go on a road trip and I want to bring a guitar. This would be pretty much the perfect guitar for that pandemic road trip that we're all kind of thinking about. It's been beat up a little bit. It's had some repairs, but it is a 1942 Marden that sounds incredible with the scallop bracing. Go to retrofret.com to ask about that or anything else that they have. Again, huge thanks to everybody for tuning in to this podcast. I can't thank you guys enough for all of the great feedback and for listening. The Fretboard Journal's 46th issue is going to press in just a few days, and that'll be mailing out in late July. And it has some amazing stories with Roseanne Cash and John Leventhal and a lot of surprises. So I hope everybody will check that out. You can subscribe now and make my life easy by subscribing ahead of time over at fretboardjournal.com. And if you use the coupon code podcast, you'll save $5 off of your order. I had mentioned a couple of great conversations we've had on this podcast, one of which is going to air next week. Woody Pfeiffer, another luthery legend, perhaps one of just a few black luthiers who are building guitars on a full-time basis independently outside of a factory environment. Pfeiffer Guitars, beautiful archtops. That's next week, and it was a good one. So thank you all for tuning in. Here is my chat with Michael Millard of Froggy Bottom, and I hope you enjoy it. I thought we should have a conversation about your anniversary and just kind of a check-in.
I'm all ears. I don't quite know what to say about the anniversary. It's In a lot of ways, I left to myself anyway, I don't think about it. It's just, you know, it's what I do. It's what I've always done. The outpouring of appreciation from the world, and especially, you know, the people that I've worked with over the years as a builder for them, or as co-workers or whatever, has been humbling, doesn't begin to cover it. I guess it's a long time. I don't know. It's in some ways it's simply surreal, you know.
Yeah.
But it's it's a lot of guitars and a lot of great people, and I guess a fairly unique path in terms of the way I've chosen to run my business and do what I do as a guitar maker. So.
What you have marched to the beat of your own drummer for decades, and I've seen other boutique, quote unquote, boutique guitar makers follow their own path. But you, in particular, you know, you're in rural Vermont. You've got a very tightly run little organization there. What has changed over the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years in terms of your process? Is there machinery in there that's was not there back in the day? Staffing, what is different?
Oh gosh. The first 25 years of doing this, I did it as a solo builder. I'm not exactly a digital person, you know. Just age-wise, that all began after my time, unless you happen to be Bob Taylor or whatever.
Yeah.
That sort of thing is not something that has ever held interest for me. I've recognized it as something that's effectively essential in order to make a living and so on. It's had to become part of what we do. In terms of machinery and stuff, you know, I mean, I used to slot fretboards on a table saw, you know, by hand, one at a time, and so on. And, you know, we have a CNC. I think the biggest thing about working with digital technology has been, twofold. One is that I've always been someone who has questioned it, because I see it in so many places as being damaging or even destructive of human creativity. And I believe that that is what makes musical instruments magical. I don't think they can be cranked down to specifications and have the same kind of, quality and, capabilities that they have when people are fully invested in them. The other thing that's different just a desire to that came along gradually to work with other people, and I think as much as anything, that's been something that has been the joy of sharing the work and so on. Anybody like me, even remotely, who's making guitars successfully out in the public eye, gets bombarded with people who are looking to do that work. And most of it is pretty naive, I guess, as you know probably as well as anyone alive. Guitars are something that kind of like fancy cars or motion pictures or whatever, generate an absurd level of is something to do with celebrity or whatever, that's just plain stupid and toxic. And an awful lot of what people searching for work in the guitar world are thinking or imagining is grossly unrealistic. I've enjoyed being in a rural place mainly because I've never been one to really circulate in the world of guitars. If I went back 20 or more years ago, I knew personally almost all of the people in the guitar world that I would say are significant or, you know, having an impact or doing good work or whatever, whether they were big or small. And in the last 20 years, I've just pretty much left all that behind, you know. Mm-hmm. I listen to guitars and I listen to players, but I don't like to run my mouth about it all, if that makes sense, you know. I don't know. There are people who have called me a curmudgeon, and I guess I don't suffer fools well in a lot of ways. I like to spend my time, you know, figuring out what makes guitars tick and trying to expand on that. I've never had a desire to, you know, have, I don't know, have my guitars be anything at all other than extremely successful in the sense of the guy that just ordered a guitar for me. I want him to feel like, wow, boy, did he nail that. It's everything that I hoped for, and maybe a bunch more. And that happens one at a time. It's not a question of, you know, what's my reputation or, you know, what's my legacy going to be or whatever. You know?
Has the construction of your guitars changed much over the years?
Fundamentally, no. One of the things that you figure out when you're trying to make guitars is, everybody has an idea, you know. I mean, the first thing is you want to make a good guitar, and then you want to make another one. I've always listened to other people in terms of what their notion of the perfect guitar, at least in this conversation, is right now between me and that person. And as long as the person is sincere in terms of what they're looking for, and I can understand why they want the guitar to work that way, then I'm good with trying to make that guitar almost always. But people have to figure out as builders how to survive. You know, most of us back in my era did a lot of repair work. You know, I put bridges in the proper place on Martin guitars for, you know, a decade. I replaced Gibson headstocks for a decade, and those and other repair stuff allowed me to see a lot of great guitars, you know, older guitars, and they also allowed me to feed myself and you know, and learn how to build. The methodology has changed, but it's been I don't know, that's been fairly subtle, you know. I think I've learned about guitars in the sense of they're critters of proportion, if you will. Refinement of proportion can make a lot of difference. And, you know, the steel string guitar is unlike a classical guitar, where the classical guitar evolved out of individuals trying to refine their own design or their own perception of what's possible in a fairly narrowly defined instrument. Steel string guitars run the gamut. I mean, there are great big ones and little tiny ones, and they got, you know, everything from a diddly bow to a harp guitar, you know, and everything in between. And so I've tried to expand my horizons in terms of when someone has knocked on the door or called me up with an interest in a project that is always functional rather than, wow, look at me, isn't this cool to look at? Anybody looking at a Froggy Bottom guitar from, I don't know, 20 or 30 feet away, it's going to look like a lot of other guitars, you know? But when you pick it up and you put it in your hands and you start, you know, tickling the thing or pushing it around, it's like, oh, I want that person to feel like, this is different, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, we've done things like we've modernized our neck attachment system, and we've certainly done a lot of stuff to accommodate repetitive tasks with a CNC. But, you know, we do setup, you know, old-fashioned way. You know, we measure everything very, very carefully and do it all by hand. We don't use a plec machine. We don't do things by the numbers or by specifications very often. And the I guess the fundamental thing that evolved over the first 10 years of of the shop was a realization that I needed to be able to vary with control, with really, really precise control, every single component in every guitar we make, so that we can, on the basis of function, really, really address the next person who walks in the door more fully and more honestly and more effectively than we have, you know, everybody else who's walked through the door. There are a lot of people who pay lip service to what we do. Everybody says they have a custom shop. Everybody says, oh, yeah, we design the guitar for you. But that's all on a continuum. And, you know, while I don't want to, you know, be sounding like I'm looking down my nose at anybody else who does that, there are not a lot of people who really do it, at least in my opinion, you know. And I made a lot of guitars.
You have. You
know, when I listen to somebody that says, you know, I'm making my 200th guitar and I'm a master and whatever, I'm like, okay, sure enough, whatever. Talk is cheap, you know. I don't know. I'm up to somewhere in the neighborhood of 5,300 guitars at this point in my life.
Wow.
And I you know, I don't like to, I don't know. I don't like to, I just don't engage in conversations with that are sort of competitive. It's not a competitive game. You know, it's how are you doing with what you're trying to do? And everyone's motives for doing what they do the way they do it are different, you know? I remember I went to a big gathering a few years ago. I was on a panel with Dick Boak and Michael Gurry, and it was 40 years in the guitar world. And those are two people who are dear friends. I respect them. I love them both. You know, personally, professionally, they're just as good as it gets. And you know, I've made a lot more guitars than both of those guys put together, and that's got nothing to do with anything. And we had somebody in the audience who was a client of mine who asked a question about comparing a Taylor guitar to a Froggy Bottom guitar. And it was becoming disparaging. And I stood up and I said, hey, zip your lip, okay? Enough of this. I said, you know, Bob Taylor has his own motives for doing what he's doing and the way that he's doing it. And when I look at what he is doing and how well he's done it, I can do nothing but bow in reverence. I could not begin to do that. And you know what? If you put any guitar I've ever made up for comparison to one of his guitars on the basis of what his motives are, I would be the biggest failure the world has ever seen. It would be ludicrous. And the guy in the audience said, yeah, well, you know, the same thing would be true in the other direction. I said, yeah, that's very true. But don't look down your nose at it, you know? I mean, I'm spending an incredible number of time with, you know, human labor that's really, really experienced. And Bob is working with a lot of digital stuff. And he's done it incredibly well. And we should be respectful of that, you know? There's room for all of that in there. And by the way, what's with the comparison? You know, is my dog bigger than your dog? It's got nothing to do with anything.
Hearing how many guitars you've made, though, and also I should just footnote, there are very few for sale, resale anywhere. People who buy them tend to hold on to them, which is a testament to how unique your guitars are. But has that number that you build per year, is that steady? Is it increasing? Is it decreasing?
Oh, it's gone up and down. One of the things, touching back on some earlier comments, the people in the shop, somebody comes to work at Froggy Bottom Guitars for one reason only, and that is because the people who are already there want to work with that person. It's not because we need somebody to do this task or that task. It's a question of, I want to work with this person, you know, this man or this woman, and we want to do that together and see what can happen with that, you know, between us. One of the things that's been really awkward for me and it's increasingly so over the years, sort of coming to a full blossom or whatever in this 50th anniversary thing. You know, everybody wants to say, "Oh, Michael Millard." Well, that's wonderful, and I'm moved. I mean, I'm grateful for that beyond anything I could possibly express with words. But in the last 25 years, you know, there has been a team of people, and it's varied. You know, we've never set out to make a lot of guitars or a few guitars. We've set out to respond to what the demand is, and to work with a group of people that is very limited in number. I think we've had maybe 8 or 9 people in the shop as the high point, you know, latter 90s, early 2000s. But we've never tried to do that with a business plan. You know, the business plan has always been, no, this guitar right now, and do it right and do it exactly as well as this person who's the client is hoping for. So, you know, there's been an ebb and a flow to this. You know, we're able to sort of step on the gas and make a few more guitars, or we're able to tone it back if we want to. You know, it's helped us because we've never borrowed money to run the business. You know, it's not something where we've ever had a line of credit or a bank loan or anything like that. It's always been organic, I guess.
That's amazing.
You know, my dad was an architect. And growing up, he was also a teacher of architecture. He was a professor of architectural design at Yale. And he did that for his entire adult life. And he circulated in a world of people who were really famous, people who were really striving to be known as the next, or I don't know, the great architect of this generation. And he kind of laughed at that, and he looked at what that did to the quality of life that they had, most of those or many of those people personally, and he just sort of went about doing what he was doing very quietly. And if you were to research his impact on the world of architecture, you know, in the latter half of the 20th century, it would be like, oh, wow, this guy made a big difference. But he really did not find it helpful to be in the spotlight. So one of the things that I've wrestled with here is in watching that, there's a team of people in the last 25 years which has varied, and the guitars that we make that everybody looks at when the world thinks, wow, that's a Froggy Bottom, that's very special, that's wow, that's as good as anything I've seen. It may not be my favorite guitar, but who knows? That guitar is a result of teamwork with a bunch of people who all have as much involvement with that guitar as I have had. I may have designed the guitar, but that individual guitar could not be exactly what it is without the complete commitment of a handful of other people. So when people start trying to make a fuss over me, I tend to go away because, number one, it's not honest or realistic or, I don't know, complete, I guess. And number two, it gets in the way of my relationship in terms of what I need to do with a given person to make that person the very best possible guitar that I can make, you know?
Sure.
It's like if everybody's like, oh wow, I'm talking to the man. It's like, no, you're talking to yourself. Can we get over that? And if we can't, you know, you should talk to somebody else. It's just silly, you know. And I understand that it's a culture we live in and what have you. But not only is it not real, but it gets in the way of us being able to have a really productive kind of relationship. Or it might even get in the way of us being able to, you know, become friends through what we're trying to do together.
Hearing you talk about these guitars, it's almost like you're a bespoke tailor and clients are coming to you with their needs. Are you that person who still fields all of those customer calls, or does your team do that as well?
It's something that is evolving. I still do most of it. It's essential that with the passage of time, other people begin to take that over. And so that's, again, it's a set of organic processes. When somebody knocks on the door, or calls up, about a Froggy Bottom guitar, they may have some illusions or even some delusions. One of the things is sad but true in our, you know, heavily capitalistic society is that, you know, the things that we make are really expensive. You know, I mean, I truly wish that we could make guitars that were every bit what these things are, and they, at least some of them, could be a whole lot less expensive, with the quality of the guitar as a functioning tool being something that is at the quality level that we deliver now. That's not always the case. But when people call up and they're talking about a guitar made out of, you know, Brazilian rosewood that, you know, I might have bought, you know, 55 years ago or something, it's worth an arm and a leg, and it's been effectively an investment for me. Sometimes those people are, they just want the thing because everybody says that's the best or that's the holy grail or whatever. They don't know about the, you know, the tonal qualities as a player would. You know, as they're not dealing with it as a tool, they're dealing with it as a showpiece or something like that. And a lot of those people can be, let's just say they're not people I want to hang around with, okay? And you see this all the time. You know, we work in the same world. So that comes into play with the person who is going to be the point man or the point person in conversation about, you know, what the guitar is. Am I making sense?
You're making sense. I'm curious, having done this for 50 years now, are, besides the screening and the expectation curbing that comes with being a luthier, are there questions you know to ask a player that I wouldn't know to ask when somebody comes to you and says, I want this size guitar in these woods? Are there certain things that you maybe wouldn't be obvious that tell you a lot about what kind of guitar that person really wants?
Always. First of all, we don't allow people to design their own guitar. You know, we don't allow people to just either knock on the door or do this, you know, over the phone or by email in a way that is, I want this, I want that. Mm-hmm. I was trained as a psychologist, okay?
I can tell.
and it was the way my dad did architecture as well. You know, we ask a lot of questions. And let me say one thing before I try to answer your question directly. And I don't know that I've ever said this publicly, at least in the context of your work and mine or whatever, but I am incredibly empowered in terms of my ability to make the guitar that, you know, John or Jane Doe really, really wants and needs, is really dreaming of, when I know more about who this person is. It doesn't mean they have to be my best friend or I have to like them or even respect them. But if I know who that person is, I couldn't tell you how it works, but I can tell you that those two things are energetically, absolutely inextricably entwined. So one of the things that I need to know is who the person is. I start with questions about, you know, how do you want this guitar to work? It's a tool in its simplest form. Is it a hammer or a screwdriver? I don't know. It's analogous to those things. But I ask people how they want to use the guitar. You know, do I sit at home? Do I sit on this edge of the bathtub at night, you know, at 2 a.m. and play for 4 hours, and that's where I use the guitar? Am I playing in a band in front of, you know, 200,000 people? Anything in between? Do I play with others? Do I play by myself? Is this the only guitar you're going to have? Is it one of 20? Is it one of many, many voices? All of these things begin to steer me in particular directions. Size has a great deal to do with it. Ergonomic comfort has a lot to do with it. Nobody wants to play a guitar that they're not comfortable with, whether it's ergonomics of the whole creature or just the neck or whatever, string gauge, attack, anything. And each person who answers those questions, the answer generates more additional questions for me. And gradually it begins to form a picture of a design of size, of scale length, perhaps of shape, and then it begins to get refined. And once the general design of the guitar has been fairly well formulated, then we talk about refinement of some of these things. Is it materials? Is it the scale length? Playability issues, highly refined elements of playability in terms of neck shape, carving. There are things like just real fundamentals that most people don't even think of. Bridge mass, string height off the face of a guitar has an enormous influence on its volume. There are people who say, I want a little tiny guitar, but I want it to sound like it's 18 inches wide and 9 inches deep. It's like, well, okay, what can we do about that? How close can we get, and where are the wise places to make compromises? So everything is proportion, absolutely everything, whether it's the size of the overall guitar, the thickness of the plates, is it the mass of the truss rod? Everything. We vary every little element of our guitars, So we try to work with all of that stuff. And yeah, there's a series of questions, but there's also a dynamic, between the person in my shoes and the person who is, the client. In terms of, why are you there? Are you there because you want the best possible guitar? Are you there because you'd also like to be really fully involved in designing that guitar as much as you can be in order to understand it? Or is it just kind of like, it's something I've always wanted to do, And anything is possible there. The whole thing is just up for grabs.
Yeah. What is your, we just talked about the thought process of dealing with direct customers. What is your thought about building a guitar on spec for a store like the Music Emporium or your handful of dealers? Do you envision a potential customer in mind and what their needs are while you're in the process of building it? Or do you, tell me about it.
It's always specific. We don't make sawdust. That is, we don't start to work wood unless and until we have the picture that is required within ourselves of exactly what that guitar is going to be. And, part of that is specifications, but part of it is like, standing outside at the end of the day and watching the sun go down and having somebody say, I want a guitar that sounds like that sunset. And, I'm being a little extreme in my allusions to poetics or whatever, but how do you describe that? You really can't with words, okay? It's simply not possible. So there is another language at play here, okay? And it involves something that is, it just doesn't involve words beyond a certain point in terms of our effectiveness in communication with each other. So when we're dealing with a client, what we do is, we have, there's a person or persons who talk with this individual. And once we get the picture, we make a list of specs, but the list of specs is only a framework. And when we're, when we're putting stuff together, if we're, we've joined a back on the guitar and a top and so on, and, we're tapping on each one of these things. And everybody in the shop who works with that guitar is going to do that. They are going to experience firsthand, okay, here's what this raw material sounds like, you know, when it's, I don't know, when a top or a back is a quarter inch thick. Here's what it sounds like as it gets thinned down in very, very precise, you know, levels of reduction. And then we say, okay, I think that's ready, okay? And there we go. They also get to hear that plate as we build the guitar, as it gets braced, okay? So they hear it then in intermediate stages, and they also get to hear the finished guitar when it's done. And hopefully, over time, they get to hear guitars come back and say, oh, this is what it's grown into. You know, one of the things that's fun doing what we do is that we get to play a finished guitar when it's first strung up, and then we have a sense instantly of, you know, where it's going. You know, mm-hmm. You know, as soon as we put the back on a guitar, you know, we build guitars backwards relative to the Martin folks. We put the back on last, we get to hear that guitar. It's like a baby, you know, wah, its first screech, okay. And we know where that guitar is headed with enough of those experiences. We can actually begin to say, okay, I know where this guitar is going to be when it's going to grow up. And that's really joyful, and it's really empowering. So everybody gets to do this all the way through all these processes. When you can change each one of these things yourself with your own hands and then see and hear and feel the difference, it becomes an accumulation of direct experience that defies, English or any other language, at least in terms of a spoken thing. You can tap and listen, or you can stroke strings and listen and say, ah, okay, that, hear that? Yeah, no, what do you hear there? Well, I hear what I hear, but this is what we're trying to do. And it goes into your catalog of, you know, visceral experience.
Wow. I know you have a client coming any minute now. What has this year been like in terms of your guitar orders? Are you steady? Are you getting an increase? Are you low?
It's over the top. We're having the best year we've ever had by a bunch.
Wow.
Well, there are a couple of things going on there. Several things, actually. One is, I'm shocked, but I'm not surprised, because, you know, if you were locked up in a pandemic or something like it, what would be the first thing you'd want to have?
Sure.
I mean, other than your best friend, or maybe your dog, you know, your kids, whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
In human terms, it would be a good instrument, the best possible instrument you could lay your hands on. So, we're seeing some of that. And we're seeing a bombardment of that. Our dealers are, for years, you know, we downsized a bunch in 2000, just before the 9/11 thing. And it was serendipitous, and it was really a wonderful thing, but it was not something we planned or whatever. So, we downsized by about 2/3 then and started making about 100 guitars a year. And so it's something that, you know, we've got the right number of people, and it's a really nice balance in terms of who we are and how much work we want to do. And, you know, everybody gets paid, nobody's getting rich, but everybody's happy. That makes a difference. Now we're having a situation where for those last 20 years, I've been trying to explain to some of the dealers, you know, if you're really cautious with our guitars, if you just buy, you know, an East Indian Rosewood deluxe grade Froggy Bottom with, you know, just it's either mahogany or Indian Rosewood, Addy top, whatever, and it's just a kind of a regular old Froggy Bottom guitar, yeah, you'll sell it, but you're not going to have them sell like hotcakes. You're going to have them sell like hotcakes when you're a little bit curious and adventurous and you explore different possibilities. We have, by virtue of our size being perfect for what we do, and all this relates to, you know, what makes sense organically going back. But when you do that, we've been able to, I've been collecting wood since the early 1960s, you know, when I was a little kid working in a boatyard. And we've got great, great wood. And when people explore that, it's kind of like, ooh, well, wood sells guitars. I mean, all of these guitars sound wonderful, but when you see something hanging on a wall or somebody opens a case and hands you this and turns it over and you look, oh my God, you know what great wood is like. It's yeah. It's just amazing. And, you know, some people love it. Some people, they couldn't care. It's all ears. But that's a big part of what we're doing now. There are a lot of people out there in this pandemic who are saying, I've wanted this for 40 years or 25 years or whatever, and damn it, do it. Even my wife tells me to do it, or my husband or whatever, you know. So that's happening. There is also, and I struggle with this for a number of reasons, but there is a surge around both the anniversary guitars. You know, they were sold without any real advertising at all. We put a blip up on the website, and in a couple of months they were gone. We only made 18 of them. But there's a group of people who are saying, can we just get one more before Michael leaves? And I'm like, don't be dumb, man. These guitars are going to be better than they ever were next year. And 5 years from now, they're going to be better than that. You know, the people who are making them are going to be the same people. They are going to have, at long last, the freedom from themselves in terms of saying, well, we got to honor Froggy and, you know, they're his work and so on. But Andy and Eric and Mark are all people who are, they're really fine musicians. They're really, really excellent players. And they've got a lot of ideas about new things to make. Andy is a great mandolin maker. He's starting to make things like mandocellos, carved top mandocellos and stuff like that. There's going to be stuff coming out of here, whether it's the same hands under, you know, his name, or it's some of it's Froggy Bottom or whatever. But those people will be making additionally great stuff in the future that's going to be like, I hope I'm around to hear it and see it, because I've been waiting for decades for, you know, at least two of these guys to just go, man, go for it, you know, and they're starting to, you know, in the last 5 years, they've really, really jumped in, you know, they haven't even held their noses. They've just jumped in and they're doing it. You know, I hear it, I see it every day. So, while it's gratifying for me to have somebody say, could we get just one more that's, you know, got your signature inside it, say, well, thank you. So, where this goes, I don't know. You know, there's so much that we're not talking about in terms of, you know, the politics in this country and the crisis and the crossroads we're at. There's so much of justice and social justice that's unaddressed in this country. You know, I was a Reverend Gary Davis kid, you know, as a teenager. I used to drive to New York to take lessons from him, an old black man. And, you know, I know what his life was like as a young man in the South. And, you know, my parents took me to civil rights marches when I was a teenager. And I was there when Dr. King told the world he'd had a dream, you know, at the National Mall. And it's all this stuff is coming to a head, and it's all connected, you know. This is a country that's built on rich white men, genocide, slavery, and unless and until we come to terms with all that stuff, we're going down in flames, and we deserve it, you know. Yeah. I don't feel guilty about it. I haven't been a part of that in my own personal life, but I am shamed for my country, and I'm also one of the people who... You know, I was born in 1947, and, you know, I heard Jack Kennedy say, you know, ask not, you know, what your country can do for you. And true or not, I grew up believing that it was not only within my power to influence, you know, the country and the world, but it was my responsibility, you know, sacredly so. And I've tried to build guitars in a spirit and in a way that... has allowed a lot of other people to make the world a better place, and I'm grateful for that opportunity. I've had more opportunity than, you know, any kid should ought to have had. You know, I've really had a life that's been blessed in more ways than I could shake a stick at. And most of it was not, I mean, anything but circumstance, you know. A lot of other people that have not had that, and we keep saying, oh, it's right here. And oh, really? I can't breathe. I'm sure the first black person who was, chained in a galley of a ship and, back in the 1500s was feeling like he couldn't breathe or she couldn't breathe as well. Mm-hmm. And it was just as true in that moment as it is today. All this stuff fits together, you and I can love music and be blessed that we were born who we were, where we were, when we were. But if we want it all to go around and come around, in positive ways for everyone, it's our job to, walk the walk now. It's time.
Yeah, true. Very true. You kind of hinted at this a few minutes ago. Are you eyeing retirement? Are you passing the torch in the near term?
I'm going to stop making guitars as a full-time thing as of New Year's Eve, the stroke of midnight, December 31st. But I will still be involved. I will still be available. I think what it means mostly is that I'm going to do what I want to do. If that means I, go play guitar to my dog out behind the barn today, then I'll do that. I will be fully available within reason to the guys, the people who are the shop in any way that they have need of me. But I want to do it on their terms, Michael Gurian told me when we first moved to New Hampshire in 1974, I took a job with him with the caveat that I'd be willing to move up here. And I was born here, I was just coming home. Mm-hmm. So that was easy for me. But I remember sitting in his living room one time playing a 12-string that I just made. And we had just gotten to New Hampshire, and all the guys were sitting around making music together, and he looked at the guitar, and he was always talking about wanting to make a Gurian 12-string, and it's something that I actually ended up making a prototype for eventually. But he looked at me, and he said, I hope that the best of you guys can really outdo me, can really take this far beyond where I've been able to take it. And I was like, it took a while for that to sink in. But I think that's a quality that is something that I've always aspired to. There are an awful lot of people, I've already said this, in the guitar world that are really competitive with each other. And it's like, it's silly. I mean, it's just like, what the hell does that have to do with anything at all here? It's anybody's self-doubt manifests itself in that way. But for the people who really love doing this and they do it with a really, really open heart, it's kind of like raising a kid. It's like, how can I possibly do this well enough? How can I possibly just give enough? It's the same thing in the world around us now. I'm talking about justice. How can we possibly do enough? So my hope is that these people have every opportunity. I'm leaving them with a turnkey operation in the sense of they have a stash of wood that is second to none. They have a reputation and a dealer network, and it's like, they have the ability, they complement each other incredibly well, in terms of character and personal nature and, personality, skill sets. It's just like, hey guys, have a great ride and how can I help? So, they're going to do that. And, the only thing that we can't really control, you know, I've said this for years, well, if the shit hits the fan on a global scale, you know, if the Yellowstone volcano erupts or something like that, we probably won't be playing too much guitar. The pandemic has given me food for thought on that. I thought, oh boy, here we go. And it's turned out to be exactly the opposite in terms of its effect on Froggy Bottom guitar. So I'm grateful. I'm humbled. But I don't know what's going to happen. You know, who the hell knows? It's life doesn't have anything to do with what we want. It has to do with what we can do, you know, with what is within our grasp or almost within our grasp. And I try to avoid expectation. You know, the Buddhists tell us that the tool that we kick ourselves in the ass hardest with is expectation. And the more quietly or tacitly those expectations are held, the bigger the wallop when the foot hits your cheeks. It's just the way it works. Whether we like it or believe it, it doesn't have anything to do with it. It's just the way, you know, reality is. So I try to get everybody in the shop to be in touch. You know, I try to get everybody to, you know, don't think too far ahead. Don't make too many plans. You know, and above everything, I try to admonish them to have a very clear picture of why they want to do something in a particular way, and understand what the trickle down ramifications of that why will have on their life, on what they're making, on how they relate to each other, and all that stuff. You know, I'm having fun being an old man. You know, it's wonderful. You know, I'm still healthy. You know, I'm still strong, and I'm looking forward to, you know, I love to fish. I love to fly fish. I'm a photographer. I love to make music. I haven't played a whole lot of guitar to speak of since I was in my mid-30s until, I don't know, the last 10 years I've started playing, you know, more seriously again. All of these things are just, they're joyful to me. You know, I've got kids. I've got grandkids. You know, if anybody's had a blessed life, you know, and had the freedom to make of their life what they really, really hoped and dreamed of, you know, you're talking to them. You
know? I love it. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you. thank you in more ways than you can know. You know, we only promote ourselves in two places right now. It's you guys and Peghead Nation. And what you had the vision of doing so beautifully and lovingly and brilliantly at the time you did it was, it's like, man, you can't script these things, you know? You can't make this stuff up. You came along at the perfect time to be the perfect vehicle for, in the simplest of ways, us being able to promote ourselves, you know, effectively to, you know, a critical part of our audience that we had never had the opportunity to address. And so my thank you is really, it's a great big, you know, I could have a biplane tow the banner over your over your building for 20 years.
Wait till COVID clears. Yeah.
Well, okay. Well, he wouldn't be picking up germs up that high. But, you know, I mean, it wouldn't express it adequately. And I that's very sincere. And it's also, no matter how strongly I feel it, Jason, it's also true. You know, the effect that your endeavor has had on my life and my work is just like, it's really beyond measure. You know,
thank you.
Sometimes stuff just happens like, wow, how about that? You know,
yeah.
You know, yeah. It just works.
Thank you. Now I'm all sappy.
Yeah.
Is the reason you do the back last because you're always fine tuning the bracing of the top and you want to wait till the last minute?
Oh, Jason, you're sharper than you know. you just sent a laser targeted question at me.
Sorry.
I'm impressed. I think it's intuitive on your part, and it's extremely telling. Almost everybody builds according to the commercial, which is to say the hold on one sec. I'll be right there, Sean. Hold on. They build according to the Martin and Gibson methodology. Okay, you know, it's commercial. It's mass produced.
Sure.
Okay, and the reason they do that, and you can deduce this, and this is the psychologist in me, but Martin puts the top on last because you can do it cleanly. That is to say, when the back goes on first, you can clean up every little teeny tiny bit of glue inside there, and it looks like wickedly clean, okay? So they're looking good, okay? It's appearance. It's not function. It's appearance. And I take issue with that. So classical builders build traditionally far more often face down, okay? And that's how I learned to build. I learned to build from Michael Gurian, who was a solo classical builder, and he applied that to steel string approach. When he started building guitars that were really mass-produced, once we moved to New Hampshire, he changed things around. And so what I figured out was, okay, everybody's trying to build guitars that run a spectrum of, I don't know, let's say stoutness. The stuff that was available for me to observe, you know, as a young guitar maker ran Martin, Gibson, Guild, some of the classical builders, some of the old, you know, Larson, you know, Washburn, the people that didn't survive the Great Depression or whatever. So I observed all that stuff and I said, why? Okay. And what I discovered was that everybody was building guitars more heavily. You know, Martin certainly did it in the aftermath of the Second World War, and it's why, oh, is it a pre-war guitar? Is it a post-war guitar? What is the proportion involved in the guitar? And one of the things that I figured out was that, you know, I watched a few, I made guitars with, sometimes with flat tops. You know, early on, I had the Gurian workshop to experiment with, and so I watched flat tops that were true flat tops. They sprang up with string tension. I watched people make guitars with a slight curve to the bracing on the top, so there was a slight arch. I watched people in the beginning, like Stefan Sobel, make really, really highly, you know, arched guitars, because he made with a mold. All of these things were possibilities. What I was dwelling on was the proportion of everything. Plate thicknesses, brace mass, measurement, height, width, curvature, carving, all of this stuff serves to address proportion. One of the things that I figured out very early on, which was just a revelation, was that I could make a lighter topped guitar in terms of the bracing or the plate or both if I put a slight arch to it and then compressed it. So I built the guitar, as I always had, face down, and when the back went on the guitar, the whole thing was strapped on and compressed that arch, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then when the clamping came off, it rebounded. And I've learned over the years to control that very, very effectively, and it makes all the difference in the world. It is one of the fundamental, maybe the single most fundamental component, if you were trying to address one and blame it all on one thing, of a Froggy Bottom guitar.
I'm glad I asked. I know you got to go.
So it's, yeah, my client has been sitting here for about 15 minutes. She's being very patient.
Okay.
Okay. Well, thanks
you,
for letting me rant.
Thank you so much.
I hope it's useful. If there's anything you want to clarify, run it by me. I'm happy to try and do that. And thanks for all you do.
All right. Glad we talked. Bye.
Take care.